You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with I almost messed it up with Daniele Friberincini. Come stai?
Bene, grazie. But you're not with me.
Well, that's virtually with you.
Fake news. Virtually with accuracy. You.
And we're rejoined. He's back from Slovenia. He made it back in one piece. Obviously didn't do a ski jump after all. Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, chaps.
How are you, Lionel? How was your little mini break?
It was lovely, thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing a very small corridor of Slovenia between Ljubljana and
Novo Mesto.
Where
were you in Slovenia? Where were you in Europe? So where is that in... just orientate as napalm, locate as in Slovenia. Because Slovenia kind of looks... On the map, it sort of looks like a pigeon facing east.
It does.
Where were you on the pigeon?
I was sort of right in the middle. Ljubljana's right in the middle.
It is.
Austria, obviously, to the north. The mountainous region to the north. Italy over to the west, of course. And then you can get into Hungary directly in the northeast.
So you're kind of in the breast.
Yeah, kind of the wing.
The wing, more the wing, maybe.
And then down to Novo Mesto, which is, I suppose, the pigeon's arse.
A quick corrections corner about the shape of Slovenia resembling an east-facing pigeon. I misheard Daniel, so Novo Mesto is not down near the rear end, it's more down near the front of the breast of the pigeon.
So near the sea then?
No, not quite that far.
So you went from the pigeon's armpit to its bottom.
Yes. Novo Mesto is probably about 10 minutes drive from the Croatian border.
Okay.
And it's kind of one of the two cycling hotbeds. Novo Mesto is the home of the Adria Mobile Continental Team. That's the team that kind of gave Primoz Roglic his break in cycling when he switched over from ski jumping. And just on that, because we always get a little bit of stick for mentioning that Roglic was formerly a ski jumper. They're very proud of that in Slovenia because ski jumping is the number one sport. Probably ski jumping and football, and then cycling is really coming up on the rails because of the success of Roglic.
Imagine ski jumping being the number one sport. That'd be like pole vaulting being our number one sport. Well, it's not something that everybody can do.
Cabre tossing in Scotland, for example. Chaps, I don't know. Is it similar? You tell me.
Have you chaps ever watched the Four Hills tournament? It's like the Tour de France of it's a blue ribbon event, ski jumping. Usually happens just after Christmas, I think.
Nope.
Always broadcast on Eurosport. Very good. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I was down in a day trip down to Novo Mesto. The other cycling, big cycling team is in the capital, Ljubljana, and that's the one that Tadej Pogacar came through because, and Jan Polans as well. Jan Polans's father, Marco, is still involved with that team, and there's a strong link between the Ljubljana team and UAE Team Emirates, of course. That's
Pog and Rog are both from that central area, aren't they, Napalm? Sort of Ljubljana, not far from Ljubljana. Pog just from north of Ljubljana, and Pog, I think, just east of Ljubljana.
But came through different systems.
Came through different teams, yes, different systems. And, I mean, everywhere's close to everywhere in Slovenia. I mean, if I'd driven an hour the other direction, I would have been in...
On the beak.
Practically in Udine, in Italy. So, it's a kind of a country of different influences. It's got an Italian influence over in the west, I gather. It's Croatian feeling down where I was, and then the sort of Austrian mountainous bit in the north. And, of course, it used to be... Well, it was the first country to break away from Yugoslavia, declare independence from Yugoslavia in the early 90s. And, I'm going to do a little dispatched from Slovenia and report back on everything.
Don't use your best material now.
No, Lionel. We'll do that.
What were you
doing
there? I mean, apart from getting under the skin of Slovenian cycling, which you've obviously done, what were you doing there?
Well, I went to see Jane Brakovic, former Discovery Channel, Astana, Radio Shack and Bahrain Merida rider who has been serving a suspension and for an anti-doping rule violation. He is returning to racing this season with Adria Mobil. He's in his mid-30s now, and I went to speak to him about quite a serious issue, really. His disordered eating, which became an eating disorder, and I wanted to go and find out more about that, and so we had quite a long conversation in his bike shop in Novo Mesto, or a bike shop he co-owns, and that interview will be a Friends of the Podcast special. I think next week we will get that out.
Great.
But it was a really, well, it's quite a serious story, a serious subject, and something that I didn't know much about and wanted to hear his side of quite a serious story.
I know you spoke to him about the sort of Slovenian cycling boom as well, didn't you?
Yeah, well, he was the first Slovenian rider, really, the first to make it to the very top level. He won the Dauphiné in 2011. His best result in the Tour de France was ninth in 2012. But an up and down career, has to be said. And when you hear his story, you'll realise why that was. He's had a rough time at times.
Can't wait to hear that. But there's been a lot of racing, some of it involving a certain Slovenian that you've already mentioned. Can you give us a little news roundup?
I can indeed. Yeah, the Tadej Pogacar is off to a flyer, isn't he? He won the Vuelta a Valenciana overall ahead of Jack Haig and Theo Gegenhardt on the podium in
first
place.
First ever all ginger podium in a race of that level, I think.
Pog's not ginger. He's not even remotely ginger.
I mean,
ginger as you are.
Gingerish. I've been called ginger.
He's definitely not ginger. Okay, I'm not
well,
having that.
Okay, well, seen in a certain light, I'm colourblind. He looks kind of gingery, maybe.
Seen in a roller disco, if you're wearing rose-tinted spectacles, yeah.
Well, okay.
He's not.
All right,
ginger.
Okay. All right.
Well, Pogacar.
So that's still to be achieved then, the first all ginger podium.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, unless he reaches for the hair dye between now and the Tour de France. Pogacar won two stages, the most difficult two. Dylan Groenewegen of Jumbo-Visma warming up for who knows what this season. He's kind of the odd man out at Jumbo-Visma, isn't he? With them naming their Tour de France team so early and him not being in it. But Groenewegen won two sprint finishes. And the other one, the other sprint finish went to Fabio Jakobsen, who won a stage of the Vuelta last year at El Puig, not far from Valencia. What else has been happening? There were the Saudi Tour, two stage wins, and the overall for Phil Bauhaus of Bahrain McLaren. A first stage victory for Nasser Bouhanni. First win in Arkea Samsic colours, but also his first win since the 2018 Vuelta. Remember that stage win came a day or two after he'd been accused of holding onto a team car, didn't it? Or on one of the climbs. So Bouhanni back to winning ways after quite a while. Jai Hindley of Sunweb won the Herald Sun Tour in Australia, and the Étoile de Passage. Something caught my eye whilst researching my climate change segment or episode or whatever that's going to end up being in a few weeks' time. The organisers of the race want to be carbon neutral by 2023. This is a week-long stage race in the south of France. It's been, I think this was the 50th edition. I think
that is such a name that conjures up early season racing, doesn't it? Gloves and leg warmers. You know, in the old days, there was no Saudi Tour or Tour Down Under. It was Étoile de Bessèges, Tour of the Mediterranean. That was it.
That's right. Yeah. And they want to be carbon neutral by 2023. I've asked Francois Thomazeau to talk to the organisers of the race about that.
Drug tests leave a carbon footprint?
Well, that's it. There were no drug tests at the race, according to Magnus Cort of EF Education First, who won the second stage. That seems highly irregular for a race of that standing and that ranking. Who else won? Ben O'Connor, continuing NTT's fine start to the season. Is this the Reese factor, the Bjarne Reese factor? I'm eating large slices of humble pie already this season, having written off Bjarne Reese's likely impact at NTT. And the final stage, the time trial, was won by Alberto Bettiol of EF Education First. And quite an important win for him. Only the second win of his professional career. The other one, of course, being last year's Tour of Flanders. And I gather that win has been weighing quite heavily on Betio's shoulders. The level of expectation he's placed on himself has been weighing pretty heavily. So perhaps that will ease things a little bit for Betio. He beat Court in that time trial by 9 seconds. The overall was taken by Benoit Cosnefroy, who had also won the Grand Prix La Marseillaise, the one-day race that precedes the Étoile de Bessèges. So the racing continues. There's loads of stuff coming up. We'll soon be back to World Tour level with the UAE Tour, which is coming up in a week or so's time. Just a couple of bits of news from away from the racing. Mark Cavendish has not been named in the Great Britain Track World Championship team. The Track Worlds are in Berlin later this month, which basically ends his any hope he would have had of riding the Olympic Games for Great Britain this year.
Berlin, you see.
Yeah, well, Daniel, will you be off to the Track Worlds, some indoor cycling?
Probably not, chaps. Probably not.
Too far to travel.
Yeah, it's at least 4 U-Bahn stops.
It reminds me of the Bill Shankly quote saying that he wouldn't watch Everton. He was a Liverpool manager, and he said he wouldn't watch Everton if they were playing in his back garden. That's literally Daniel's approach to track cycling. And Team Ineos, their continued expansion around the world of sport continues. I wonder how much of this has been prompted by Bahrain's tie-up with McLaren, but Ineos and Jim Ratcliffe in particular are investing in Formula One Mercedes team. So a bit of crossover there.
Buff, I noticed, prior to this announcement by Ineos yesterday, there was some speculation that they might be announcing the launch of a women's team. Was that just wayward supposition or what?
It's not. There's strong speculation that Ineos and EF Education First are certainly planning or hoping to launch women's teams. I think with EF Education First, they need some extra sponsorship. They need some more funding. Ineos, I imagine, just need to write a check. I was interested on that to hear that the Ineos investment in the Formula One team is $20 million a year, which is less than they're putting into their cycling team.
And much less than they're putting into Nice Football Club.
Yeah, which is, it's a sort of dipping your toes in the water in the context of Formula One, isn't it? But yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's an Ineos women's team next year. I went to the team for comment on this story a few months ago at the World Championships. The rumour was floating around, and all they would say was there wouldn't be a women's team in 2020, which left the possibility open of there being one in 2021.
One of the issues with EF, the company itself, is that they have gender parity when it comes to salaries in the company itself. And
yes,
so that would have an impact on the cycling team, that because a rider in the women's team would make the arguable case that they are the team leader, so they would want wage parity with the men's team. That's the next big jump for women's cycling, isn't it?
And one of the peculiarities of that team is that it actually belongs to EF, does it not? So the riders are in effect EF employees, which is not something that can be said about a lot of other riders in other teams, because they're employed by the management company, who is sort of subcontracted by
Same with Ineos, isn't it? I mean, Ineos, like Sky, own the team lock, stock and barrel.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. We're seeing the main man later on, aren't we, Lionel? We're meeting up with Stephen Moon of Science and Sport later on. We didn't say where we were. We are in Little Italy in Soho, surrounded by love heart shaped balloons.
Just for us.
Is that right? There's a love heart literally just hanging over your head. The tip of it is almost scratching your pate.
Not quite. We're next door to Bar Italia, aren't we? Where there's some cycling memorabilia in there, isn't there?
A lot of cycling
posters
memorabilia,
and old cycling magazines, Italian cycling magazines on the wall.
And they very generously let us record the podcast upstairs here. So.
And they very generously let us have a post 11 o'clock cappuccino.
They did. We had a couple of cappuccini. Daniele, a couple of cappuccini. Do you like that? Is that good?
Yeah, yeah,
practicing,
good.
Practicing for Hungary. anyway, the main talking point, I suppose, of the early racing is Pogacar. I mean, he was on fire at the start of last year, wasn't he? He won in Algarve. He seems a very consistent rider because he was really, you know, established early on last year that he was at a good level and continued that. Tour California he won, and then of course at the Vuelta, but he's really started this season extremely well and looked very impressive indeed in winning in the south of Spain. What do we make of that? I mean, I thought it was a good team performance as well from UAE. I imagine he's still going to be riding in support of Fabio Aru at the Tour de France.
Oh,
of course.
Come on. Really?
As he said, no, I don't imagine that. I mean, the guy's so young, but really, having finished third at the Vuelta, is it outlandish to imagine that he's not an actual contender for the Tour de France this year, which he is going to ride?
Are we going to be calling this the cycling podcast?
It's not, yeah.
In July?
I don't want to go too hard on the speculation, but he looked good, didn't he, Daniel?
Well, Pogacar has now won the last three hilltop finishes he's competed in, because he won the last one at the Vuelta on the penultimate day, and won three stages there, of course, at the Vuelta, the two uphill finishes at Valenciana. He looks incredibly good, Rich. I would also suggest that in the final stage, the stage that finished above Altea, he was also not going as deep as a lot of the guys he beat there. That was something that I noticed Nicolas Portal, the Ineos director sportif, he said. And you know, just watch the way the guys came over the line there. It was very steep, last 500 metres or so. And everyone who was sort of chasing him and admittedly gaining on Pog, they sort of dribbled over the line and almost fell off their bikes. And Pog looked relatively fresh by comparison. And so he sort of cruised to overall victory there. And, you know, considering how early it is in the season, very impressive indeed. Also, considering a few other things, I understand he's changed quite a bit in his training over the last few months, doing quite a bit more sort of intensity. But any change, you know, can be difficult to sort of assimilate, particularly for a young rider. So, you know, he seems to have done that. He's also moved. He's moved to Monte Carlo in the last 3 or 4 months, I think. So that's another change. He's probably, there's no doubt he'll have had, a lot more sort of engagements and things to attend over the winter. There was quite a lot of attention, rightly so, for everything that he achieved last year. So, you know, quite a lot on his plate. But seems to have come into the season absolutely flying. He's been at altitude at the Sierra Nevada. Rich, I don't know if you're aware of his girlfriend. Her name is Ushka Zygaard. Mm. And we saw her around at the Vuelta last year. I think she's predominantly been a mountain biker in the past, but she signed for the Ale Cipollini team.
Yeah, which is a World Tour team. And she's a couple years older than him, but a good rider. I don't think she's going to set the heather on fire, but she's a decent rider, and will be riding on the road this year. Yeah,
yeah, and she's been training with him in Sierra Nevada. So
is going to set the heather on fire. Then who knows?
Perfect start for him, and he's got the. I think his next big goal is the UAE Tour next week. And I noticed today that the route of the UAE Tour has been changed, and now there's another. Well, there's a second stage that finishes on top of the Jebel Hafit climb, and there was previously only one, but they've tweaked that, and that's gonna help Pog. And you know, his team is Team UAE Emirates, huge race for them. So he would now, I guess, become the favourite to win that race with two mountaintop finishes.
Yeah, could be a second Slovenian victory in that race in a row, because Primoz Roglic won there last year. And looking at Pogacar's run to the Tour de France, it's a pretty grown up race programme, isn't it? Paris-Nice, and then Milan-San Remo, then Itzulia in the Basque country, and then Amstel Flesh in Liège, and then the Dauphiné before the Tour de France. I mean, it's a classic run to make his first appearance at the Tour de France. And
I wonder what the thinking is behind the San Remo appearance.
Well, attack on the climb and
well,
try
yeah,
and win
I mean
it.
That's you would have to think if they've put him
direct
in there,
sportif Lionel Burney here.
Well, if they've put him in there, it's with a view to him, you know, not just sort of getting the 290 kilometres in the tank. It's also with a view to maybe trying something.
Just on the rejig of the UAE Tour, they've got two summit finishes on the same climb, the toughest climb that they can that's been in the race in the past. Because Hatter Dam is another uphill finish, but that's where Caleb Ewan won last year. So it's not real. Pure climbers territory, but I'd love to see these roadworks that have forced them to put in a second summit finish that would absolutely suit UAE's Tadej Pogacar.
Yeah, that did
down
occur
to me
as well, Napalm.
I mean,
shades of the 1984 Giro front and the helicopter flying over the supposedly snowbound. Was it the Gavio or Stelvio, which was completely clear of any snow?
I imagine that there'll be some people out with road braking equipment just to ensure that there's five summit finishes at Jebel Hafit this year, maybe.
Well, anyway, he's looking very good indeed as Tadej Pogacar. I mean, the point you make about riding maybe within himself on the climb, I think he went so early that he was able to manage his effort perhaps better than those behind who were, you know, having to try and sort of bridge up or attack each other, and that's a harder thing to do, especially on such a steep climb. And it looked at one point like Dan Martin almost reeled him in, but just couldn't quite close it, and then he went backwards and Pogacar was able to just carry on. But yeah, he looked powerful and very much in control. And you know, if I was UAE Team Emirates, I'd be thinking, yeah, this is a guy that can definitely go to the Tour and be a serious contender for it.
I think one of the daunting things, Rich, for his rivals is also that, you know, the Vuelta last year, the Vuelta is notorious for its short, steep climbs, and he was excellent there. He won on Los Machucos, for example, incredibly steep climb, but he doesn't particularly enjoy that kind of effort, and I think he feels that he's better suited to the longer climbs.
Which, given his build, you can well believe. You know, he's a big, sort of powerful climber, good time trialist as well. He's not a little small kind of climber who might excel on those sorts of finishes.
How confident would you be in his team, both from the point of view of personnel? I mean, they've invested quite a lot, and they've over the last couple of years, really. You know, guys like David de la Cruz have come on board for Formolo. Some pretty big names. They've got Joe Dombrowski as well, but also from that point of view, personnel, and also, you know, they don't really have the same reputation for innovation, or they haven't had as maybe Jumbo Visma or Ineos, and you know, they're on Colnago bikes, the sort of old school traditional Italian manufacturer.
I think they're kind of shaking off the shadows of the old Lamprey team that they've evolved from, aren't they? It looks a lot more dynamic now than it did even two or three years ago. The fact that they've signed up some young talent, Pogacar being one, but also Brandon McNulty. I'm not saying he's going to suddenly be a key part of the Tour de France team this year, but it looks like they've got a bit more going for them. They've also got Fernando Gaviria, who can win sprints, which, you know, would take the pressure off in terms of, you know, not everything being on Pogacar's young shoulders. And well, looking at the riders that they could call on, the experience of Ulissi, Jan Polans, Formolo, Dombrowski, De La Cruz. I mean, there's not a bad Tour de France team in there, and who knows, Fabio Aru may even you know, come back from
the dead.
Well,
he's been going very well, apparently. So, by his own admission.
Just looking at that, I mean, you say they're shaking off the shadows of Lamprey. They're down to 8 Italians this year. It was 11 last year, and 13 or 14, I think, the previous year. So, they are gradually emerging, or you know, metamorphosing into a more international team, aren't they?
Just finally on Pog, Rich, I would recommend, if anyone wants to find out more about Pog, because we know he's not the most expansive of speakers. His website is actually very good, and he's even got a blog or a plog, which contains quite a lot of information. These are it's a bit of a sort of artifact now, isn't it? The riders website. All the top riders had websites 10 or 15 years ago, but they've been sort of surpassed and rendered obsolete by Twitter and Instagram and we don't see many of them anymore. But yeah, Pog has got his own logo. He's got this sort of wolf rocket type hybrid logo. Hasn't given himself a nickname yet. Maybe we can come up with something. I thought maybe the Pog Father. Of course, infamously, he was reading The Godfather at the Vuelta last year, the Mario Puzo novel, which of course is a famous film.
Yeah, I had a look at his plog, it was quite.
It's
quite
a good
charming.
Plog, isn't it?
Not bad. Yeah, it gives little insights into his training and so on.
He went to see Eminem in before Christmas when he was in Dubai. Big fan of Eminem. He's got that in common with Elton John.
You can also buy a Pogacar calendar or baseball cap, t-shirts. I mean, we're doing his marketing for him here, aren't we? I'm surprised. I mean, he's only 21. I'd have thought he'd have had, you know, whatever's taken over from Snapchat, you know, websites. I mean, what is he? Some kind of granddad?
Next thing, Remco Evenepoel will be producing a fanzine.
Well, Evenepoel doing his fanzine, Valverde will be sending out by return of post a 7-inch single with his latest thoughts recorded on it.
Valverde, like the old days. I did want to ask you about him because we did a bit of a special on Movistar last week, and you made the point, Daniel, about how dependent that team, a real new look team with a very young team, how dependent they're going to still be on him for results. And I thought, we've said this before, but Valverde, are we seeing the first real signs of decline? Because a couple of finishes in particular there, you would have thought would have suited the Valverde at his best. And he's, let's face it, he's always at his best. You know, he is very, very consistent, but didn't really look like he had it last week, did he?
Well, it's the worst start to a season since he was suspended.
1968.
Probably. But I mean, again, you know, he is going to be 40 in April. I imagine the decline won't be dramatic.
Think he'll have a 40th?
Yeah, maybe. 40th a spa bash. Weekend. Golf trip. Or something. What do you reckon? What would Valverde do for his 40th? Just a quiet meal in a restaurant.
Try and win Liège Bastogne Liège.
With the music turned down, because, you know, you can't hear anything once you get to 40, can you? As you'll find out later this year, Daniel, I think.
Oh, I like it.
I'm sure about that.
Sorry. We're already well over that hill. Don't worry. We're on the descent, tackling the bends like a 50p that's been dropped down a hill.
There's no sort of universal template for that, is there? How quickly riders start to decline. I mean, for some, it's literally it's disappeared almost overnight in a closed season, in an off season. They've come back one year in a February or March, and they've not seemed to be the same rider and never managed to get it back. Whereas with others, it is a sort of slow ebbing, waning over several years, or certainly at least several months.
Do you not think that, I mean, Valverde, you know, he's been there or thereabouts for, you know, so long, but last year the wins weren't exactly, you know, they weren't cascading forth, were they? He won a stage of the Vuelta, and the rest of his victories were, and the national road race, of course, in Spain, but the, you know, a stage of the UAE Tour and a couple of stages of the, what was the Route du Sud, the Route d'Occitanie, not the kind of Valverde of old, but still they're still in the mix. I wonder whether how much of it will be mental when he thinks he hasn't got what it requires to go with the younger riders, and we'll find out, won't we? But I don't see him being the same force, and I think perhaps that the fact that he is now the totemic figure in Movistar, you know, that puts a bit of pressure on as well. It's not like there's a load of other riders that can... There's not the same competition within the team, perhaps. Maybe that was what was keeping him going.
His 40th, actually, is the day before Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year. Another rider who we're watching closely for signs of still having the old magic, I suppose, Mark Cavendish, who was in action in Saudi Arabia. What did we make of his performance there? Obviously, his teammate Phil Bauhaus, Phil Powerhouse, he should be called, won a couple of stages, won the overall with a bit of a controversial sprint against Nasser Bouhanni, perhaps. I didn't think it was that controversial, to be honest, but Bouhanni complained that he moved from his line.
I thought it was quite controversial, Rich, but what is more controversial, I think, is just every time something like this happens, if you go and look at the UCI regulations, they're almost reasonably vague. Riders shall be strictly forbidden to deviate from the lane they selected when launching into the sprint, and in doing so endangering others. You know, there's no mention of sort of what constitutes deviation, what sort of distance do you, you know, is a 10 centimeter deviation, does that cause an infringement, or does it have to be a meter, 2 meters, 3 meters?
It depends, you know, on the situation, doesn't it? I think these things have to be situation specific, and you know, a deviation of 10 centimeters in one context, it depends also where the rider behind you is, which is sort of out of the control of the rider in front. That's why I think the rider in front should be allowed a certain leeway to move his line. That's that, if you're in front, that's the, you know, that's the opportunity that you've earned for yourself, really, to be able to move your line. And whether that makes it dangerous for the rider behind, that's really up to the judges on the day. I didn't think it was particularly dangerous maneuver by a house in that.
I mean, I always feel that this kind of vagueness is a ticking time bomb, and it's fine when it's stage 4 or 5 or whatever it was of the Saudi Tour in February, but then if we come to a world championship and it's you know, it finishes in a bunch sprint, like we saw in Yorkshire last year in the under 23 race, there's a rule that's, you know, people haven't paid enough attention to for years, and then the stakes a high one day and you realize how inadequate this rule is, and and it becomes a huge story and a huge, well, scandal.
True. What about Cavendish though? What did you make of his performance out there, Daniel?
Well, he got an assist, didn't he? He was, or appearing to be, led out by Bauhaus, but didn't, he sort of fainted, didn't he? Didn't accelerate behind Bauhaus. Bauhaus got a gap and then carried on sprinting and eventually won. On the other days, I suppose it would have been nice to see Cavendish just get in the mix in a sprint. You know, you sort of feel that the path, the road back for him towards being competitive is a sort of few 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th place finishes, and at least being in the mix. That didn't really happen, but on the other hand, you know, there were days when Bahrain McLaren were very much at the front, forcing the pace and splitting the bunch in crosswinds, and he was there. So his fitness, I think, is good, and he's actually, you know, he's ridden and trained very, very consistently over the last few months. He hasn't had the luxury, really, of a long break over the winter. So I think his general fitness is good, but you know, what he needs is not the ability to sort of stay in a peloton and finish races. It's the ability to win and contend for races. That's what everyone's looking for.
And what about the fact the race was being held in Saudi Arabia at all? It's obviously an ASO race, isn't it? Saudi Arabia has really stepped up its involvement in sport over the last year or so, hasn't it? There was the Anthony Joshua fight there in December. The Spanish Super Cup, which is basically it's morphed into the sort of the cup winners and the league champions and runners up playing in a mini tournament, has that was held in Saudi Arabia as well. Rumours that the Saudi Arabian government is behind a takeover attempt at Newcastle United Football Club, and talk of a Formula One Grand Prix being held in Saudi Arabia has attracted the criticism of Human Rights Watch. I mean, it feels like it's another step on a journey that international sport has been on over the last decade, and I think. It's a difficult one because it's about the regime rather than the sort of ordinary citizens of Saudi Arabia. But I must confess, I didn't watch any of the Saudi tour at all. Not for any great kind of moral reason, but certainly it felt to me anyway like a further step on a journey that international sport has been taking.
Then again, our country sells arms to Saudi Arabia. They're a key ally of the country that we live in,
and absolutely
where we vote. And so it seems to me that complaining about sporting events happening there seems to me less important than material things like that go on that do actual harm.
I completely agree with you there, and I wonder as well. I mean, people say it's sport washing. That's the term, presenting these countries in the most positive light possible by holding high profile sporting events there. Obviously, they have the money to attract events, but on the flip side, it puts into the spotlight some of the. Some of the more dubious practices of those regimes. I mean, I don't know. I just thought, as a sport, any LGBT riders or staff, really, it's not exactly an inclusive, welcoming step, is it?
It's not. I mean, the UAE tour is the next one, and you can make a lot of the same arguments there.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's been a progression, hasn't it? That 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I probably would have made the same point about Beijing hosting the Olympics. And, people did make that point back then. The human rights of China came under the spotlight, didn't they? So, it's a difficult one. I have no firm conclusion. Daniel?
Well, we can at least count ourselves lucky that we weren't treated to one of the major protagonists responding to, when challenged on this issue, in the same way that Phil Mickelson, the golfer, responded when he was asked why he was playing in the Saudi Open, which is another event that has been launched this year, Rich. And that was just before the Saudi tour, a week before. And his... he was challenged on why he was missing the Phoenix Open that he'd played in for 30 years to go and play in Saudi Arabia. His reply on Twitter was, "I understand that those who are upset or disappointed, you'll be okay. I have enjoyed my previous visits to the Middle East and I'm looking forward to playing in a new country and doing my bit to grow the game in the kingdom." You'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean it.
To anyone who's got an issue with it.
I completely understand your point of view, Lionel, but... It seems to me that if we're going to protest something, the priority should be protesting what our government is doing, frankly, over the right of Saudi Arabia to host a major sporting event. This one organised by ASO, of course.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views and interviews from the world of professional cycling. Support our work and get exclusive episodes by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe.
Well, Lionel, I think we've got episode 2 of Mitch Docker's interview series going out this week.
We have Life in the Peloton, and it's a cracker. It's with Andre Greipel, who, something of a closed book to me, certainly. I've never had much joy talking to him at races. It's always been quite difficult to...
Clipped,
yeah. I mean, going back to the Champs-Élysées in Paris, when I asked whether he would spare a few minutes for outside the team bus, he just said no. So, but he was very happy to speak to Mitch for
an
episode.
In fact, he'd been pestering him to go on his podcast, apparently.
Has indeed, yeah, for a year or so. When are you going to get me on, Mitch? So, Mitch Docker, well, it's a great conversation, and we learn a lot. Certainly, I learned a lot about Andre Greipel, and it's really an entertaining listen, and that will be on our feed very shortly. Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton, new to the Cycling Podcast this year, fortnightly interviews, and yeah, they're dropping into our Dropbox from Mitch with very reassuring regularity, that's
good.
For sure.
I've been listening to Greipel and it's fascinating. It goes right back to his upbringing when he and Jan Ulrich, someone that you know, Daniel, had the same coach in East Germany. Or
I know him well.
Yeah, they came through the same kind of cycling school. So it's a really, really, sounds like a great listen. Greipel's really opened up to Mitch. So yeah, I look forward to the other ones as well.
Welcome, Andre Greipel. Welcome to Life in the Peloton.
Hello, and I'm really glad and happy as a follower also to be part of your podcast, Mitch.
You have actually been asking me for a couple of years, when are you going to get me on the podcast? And I was like, really? You do it? And I was like, I can't believe Gripes wants to come on my podcast. So I've finally pinned you down and got you on here. So welcome. Great.
Yep. Thanks.
2014, Tour of Luxembourg, solo victory. Very uncommon for a sprinter in my eyes to do that. Run us through what happened that day. Last stage of Tour of Luxembourg.
Actually, this is my only victory I could manage to get solo. So, yeah, I was flying on that day somehow. I really wanted to go deep just ahead of the Tour de France and prepare also the German championships. So the last day was anyway uphill finish. So I just wanted to go on the break and wanted to go really deep. And somehow, yeah, that break stayed away, or we could manage somehow to make it stay away. And at the end, I was the only one who stayed away. I was quite strong and smart somehow as well. So I always went when it was necessary, super hard. And yeah, I can descend quite well. So nobody could manage to get me back. Yeah.
So that was Mitch Docker in conversation with Andre Greipel, a little flavour of what to expect. And you'll find his podcast on our feed. We're doing events in the US. When I say we, I'm doing events with the latest member of the Cycling Podcast team, Ian Boswell. Something we've wanted to do for a while.
How are you getting over there? Flying out there in Jet Podcast One, or what's our private jet called again?
The Pod Jet.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have a private jet. I'll be taking conventional transport there. New York on the 8th of April and Washington, D.C. on the 9th of April. And I'll be in conversation with Ian Boswell. Details next week. Tickets will go on sale next week. Friends of the podcast will get a 24-hour head start on tickets for that. So if you live in Washington or New York and haven't yet signed up as a friend of the podcast, now is the time to do so. If you want to come to these two events.
It's starting to feel like when Robbie Williams left Take That to try and crack America.
You're welcome to come with me, Lionel. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe to sign up as a friend of the podcast. And you'll also get our next friend special, which is Lionel's conversation with Jani Brajkovic, which should be out next week as well. Anyway, more details about my events with Ian Boswell next week. And Ian Boswell will, of course, contribute to the Explore series, which is relaunching as a monthly episode very soon.
Very soon, yes. Well, we're waiting for a couple of things to just drop into place, aren't we, before we break the seal on Explore again. But it will be back very, very soon. First episode is all recorded, all done. We're just, we're hoping to have some news on another front, aren't we, shortly.
We are. Now, a story that we mentioned in passing last week was Cameron Wurf, the Australian rider, joining Team Ineos, a surprise replacement for Vasyl Kiryienka. Our colleague in Australia, Rob Arnold, then sent us through an interview with Cameron Wurf, who he obviously knows quite well. Just to get a bit more on his quite unusual background, he is, I think you were you were called out on Twitter, Daniel, for sort of downplaying his triathlon record. He's not just a kind of park triathlete, is he?
I didn't say he was.
No, he's a proper Ironman, and obviously a former World Tour professional as well, and now a World Tour professional again. So, got quite a background and quite an interesting character. Here he is in conversation briefly with Rob Arnold.
Dave actually Brailsford asked me to come to the team camp at the end of November or early December. It was in Mallorca, and that's generally for the whole team, you know, all the riders. And obviously, I wasn't a rider, but it was, you know, I'd been around enough, and it was sort of, you know, I hadn't ever been to that camp with everyone. And, you know, he said, come along, and they just sort of slotted me in as, in with the group, and just did my thing, and, you know, did some hard TT efforts with Rowan, and, you know, we did some team workouts, and one day we decided to do a lap of the island. Well, four of us did, Dylan Van Baal and G. Geraint and Ian Stannard. The four of us did a full lap of Mallorca, 312K. Mm-hmm. So I think Dave, you know, certainly noticed that I seemed to fit in with the group really well, and he sort of made a comment that it was a shame that they had 30 riders on the roster, because, you know, jumping in for the odd race with the team could actually be really good for them and for me, you know, as I continue to progress my triathlon career. So that was sort of where that was at. And they've actually got a situation, obviously everyone knows, with Andre Amador. He's actually not there yet, so we're kind of waiting on that. And that's still yet to be resolved. And then this just popped up. And when, you know, it popped up with Kirianka, and Kiri decided that was what he wanted to do, Dave was very adamant to act extremely decisively and swiftly to bring me in, replace, put me on the team and get me racing ASAP, because it was something we talked about for a long time, and it was a case of we finally had the window, and that's make it happen. So, you know, Wednesday last week I was sitting in LA, or it was Thursday actually, and here we are a week later, 8 days later, and I'm sitting here in Geelong about to do my first race in 5 years. So it just goes to show, you just got to make the most of every opportunity that comes your way. That's what I intend to do with this. At the moment, the plan is that I'll race up until around May, you know, when the team does the Giro. And then, of course, you got the rest of the guys getting ready for the tour. So, you know, that's... And over the summer, I do my usual couple of Ironmans, do Nice and probably Roth, and maybe do my TV stuff with SBS, and then start to get ready for Kona. But... yeah, who knows? You know, I mean, the reality is it's the best team in the world, and I haven't raced for 5 years, and, you know, I think I've improved as an athlete. You know, I think certainly my mentality towards what I do is very different, and they're certainly intrigued as to what's going to happen. You know, I mean, they're interested to see what I can do. I mean, I wasn't that bad a bike rider when I did ride. I just wasn't as good as I felt that I could be, and I felt like I was kind of wasting my time. So, who knows? Obviously, I'd love to ride the Tour de France one day. You know, I mean, that's always been an absolute dream of mine. I've done Kona, I've been to the Olympics, and, you know, to obviously do the Tour would really complete the set. And but, you know, on this team, it's, you're not just going to do the Tour, you're going to be a part of a winning team, and that is even more inspiring to potentially put my hand up. Of course, I'd love to do that, but at the moment it's not a focus, it's not a target.
So that was Cameron Wurf, the new Team Ineos signing, and Daniel, were you going to say something about Tour Colombia, which is getting underway as we speak?
Well, no, it's just that I think people...
It's getting underway as we speak.
Well, I think last year, those of us who weren't lucky enough to be there saw the images from the race and the crowds, and, it gave a real sense of the sort of explosion in interest that there's been in Colombia on the back of the riders' success, really, over the last few years. And, the Tour of Colombia is happening this week, six stages, between kind of Medellin and Bogota is most of the stages. The final stage should be a humdinger. It's starting in Zipaquirá, which is where Egan Bernal is from, and it finishes 3,270 meters above sea level, just outside Bogota, on a mountain overlooking Bogota. One of the highest finishes ever for a major race. Our friend Hannah Troop from EF Education, the press officer, EF Education, was actually asking me the other day whether that will be the highest ever summit finish in a sort of elite race. And it won't be, because the Tour of Qinghai Lake in China takes place, pretty much the whole race takes place at around that altitude, 3,200 meters. And there is a finish that they do at Qinghai Lake, which is 3,780 meters, I think, above sea level. So it's not the highest, but the whole race, the Tour Colombia, is taking place around about 2,000 or above 2,000 meters altitude. So yeah, it's one for the mountain goats. The route itself is lumpy, hilly. As I say, it will be decided on the final day. And there's a cracking field. All the big ballers you'd expect to be there. Bernal, help me out. Chavez. All those boys. Carapaz.
Chavez is riding for Colombia, isn't he, rather than Mitchelton Scott.
Correct.
Bernal, of course. Richard Carapaz will be there. You mentioned him. Sergio Henao. And also, Rigoberto Urán and Sergio Higuita and Daniel Martinez as well, the triumvirate at EF Education first. And also, José Rujano, the Venezuelan, who recently expressed a wish to make it back to World Tour level. He'll be riding for Venezuela. It's a long way back for him, I would suggest. The last time he raced in Europe was with Vacansoleil in 2013, or raced consistently in Europe was with Vacansoleil. Previously with Quickstep, of course, briefly, Castapan. 37 years old now. Best result was, what was it, third in the Giro? Fourth in the Giro? Third in the Giro in 2005.
Third in the Giro. The one notable absentee is Nairo Quintana, whose Arkea team is not going to be there, which is a bit of a shame.
Also, Miguel Angel Lopez, last year's winner, not taking part. But other than that, the Colombian ballers, as you describe them, Daniel, are all there.
Talking of ballers, have you chaps been doing any cycling recently? Haven't talked about that for a while. Any goals for the season? What are your goals for the season, you boys?
I'm doing Ride London, actually, in August, because the main charity this year is pancreatic cancer, and my mother passed away with pancreatic cancer some years ago, 15 years ago this year. So I'm doing Ride London.
You're not expecting to win it, are you?
I would say that's a long shot. I mean, that's unlikely. But I am hoping to finish it. Unfortunately, it clashes with the opening weekend of the Vuelta, which is very unfortunate, because the Vuelta starts... Well, it's very late, and the Vuelta is very early this year, so it does clash. But I am putting together a team to do Ride London. And I've been training a bit on my trainer, using a bit of Zwift and a bit of Trainer Road, and quite enjoy that, although I've been ill the last few weeks, so I haven't been doing anything at all.
Oh dear.
Just the old Pilates, Lionel. What about you? You've been
running, really?
Fit?
Running. Yeah, just 5Ks. That's it.
In total?
Well, at a time.
Okay. That's what about you, Daniel? Really? You fit?
Always fit, Rich. Training for nothing big coming up. Still waiting for the dates on the speed golf, on the British Speed Golf Open this year, and a few other tournaments. And then November, big goals in November, and it's a trail race, ultra trail race in Mallorca, 59 kilometers.
Is that the only reason you brought up this subject? Is that the only reason you asked us if we were doing anything in order to...
Well, I didn't expect to have to about my own.
What is it? It's a how long trail race?
It's 59 kilometer ultra trail running.
That's a long way.
It's a long old way, yeah.
I did a 100-kilometer trail running race back in 2002, and I needed a hip replacement after that. Eek. So good luck. Shall we, on that note, because one name caught my eye when we were going through some of our good friends of the podcast we want to say our thank yous to, I'll kick it off. So a big thanks from me to some of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast. Very grateful to you for your support. Thomas McLaughlin, Gavin Stewart, Derek Morgan, Chris Lawrence, Alwyn Gosford, Marcus Banks, the man who replaced my hip, Dougal Monk, Teresa Griffiths, and Stephen Maggs.
Barry Morris, Paul Packham, Daniel Gentili, Bryn Thompson, Mark Vanderventer, Andrew Cox, Paul Winkler, Sean Donoghue, Edwin McClarty.
And a big thank you from me, well, from all
yours
of us.
Yours are all from Watford.
Gordon Holtman, Bill Jankowski, Simon Wallington, Chris Staples, Peter Cook, Brian Power, Neil Brown, Yussi Isotalo, Holly Carson, Jeff Gins, and Stephen Hardacre. You've all signed up as friends of the podcast this year using our super new system. Thank you very much. You are directly helping us to plan our year and go and cover the three grand tours.
And all the people we've thanked so far and will continue to thank are the people who've signed up as very good friends or best friends, and we'll be getting a signed copy of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries. We've got a big bundle of them here to send out. There's a little bit of a backlog, but actually we're on top of that now. So if you sign up as a good friend of the podcast, you should get a book pretty quickly. And those who are still waiting, it should arrive imminently.
And plenty to listen to already on the feed, isn't there? We've released the Tour de France chapter of our Grand Tour Diaries as an audiobook. And, well, coming in the next week or so will be my conversation with the Slovenian rider, Jani Brakovic.
That's all for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.